Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Gelton, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Social scientists and policymakers generally focus on jobs, public assistance, and mass incarceration as the big problems facing America's low-income families. But Matthew Desmond, a Harvard sociologist, says the lack of access to affordable housing has become a major cause of poverty, one that's often overlooked. His new book is Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. Desmond joins me here in the studio. Also with us, Rolf Pendel, director of the Metropolitan Housing and Communities Policy Center at the Urban Institute. We have some dramatic stories to relate, and I'm sure you'll want to weigh in with your own thoughts and questions. We'll be taking your calls. Our number is 1-800-433-8850. We'll be reading your emails. Send them to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us via Twitter or on our Facebook page. Matt and Rolf, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Matt, let me say, first off, that this is an exceptional book.
Thank you.
You know, we journalists think of ourselves as good storytellers and sometimes regard the work of academics as a little bit dry and sometimes wonky. But Evicted is as gripping a nonfiction narrative as I've read in a long time. And I'm thinking it's because you lived with the people that you write about for such a long time, more than a year, right?
That's right.
And that's like what anthropologists do, ethnography. In fact, I think you describe yourself in your work as ethnography. But sociologists don't do that so often. Why is it that you decided to take this ethnographic approach to what you're writing about?
You know, poverty had always bothered me. You know, America stands alone in comparison to all wealthy democracies for the depth and expanse of its poverty. And I really wanted to understand that and understand the role that housing particularly plays in deepening inequality in this country. And so I thought the best way to do that was the old-fashioned way, is by embedding myself in the lives of families that are getting evicted, but also their landlords doing the evicting. Mm-hmm. And so I lived in a trailer park on the far south side of Milwaukee, rented a trailer there for several months. And then I moved into a rooming house on the north side, which is the traditional inner city area of that city, and lived there for about 10 months. And from those two areas, kind of went everywhere with these families and with these landlords and tried to really understand what poverty looks like on a day-to-day basis.
Now, you say you were interested in the role that housing plays in poverty. To me, that's like the most important. That's really the groundbreaking aspect of your book, is that you are able to highlight that in a way it's never been before. Was that your thought going in, or did you go in, did you sort of discover in the course of your work how important housing was in explaining poverty?
I discovered a lot. You know, I discovered a lot. I had no idea how frequent evictions were. You know, evictions, I thought, might be a lot more rare. In the city of Milwaukee, there's about 40 people every day in the summer and the winter evicted from their homes. You know, that was astonishing to me. And I think that most Americans, if they don't live in trailer parks or in the inner city, think that the typical low-income family lives in public housing or benefits from some kind of housing assistance. But the opposite is true. Only about 1 in 4 families who qualify for housing assistance receive anything. So the vast majority of low-income Americans are living unassisted in the private rental market, giving almost everything they have to pay for housing.
Almost everything they have. Be a little bit more specific about the people that you lived with. How much of their income was going to housing?
Sure. I think of people like Arlene, who was a single mom of two boys, who was living in a rundown two-bedroom apartment in a very poor neighborhood in America's fourth poorest city, giving 88% of her income to rent. I think of Lorraine, who was a grandmother in the trailer park that I lived in. She received disability for a childhood fall she took. She was paying over 70% of her income to rent. And, you know, these stories aren't unique. You know, we've reached a point in this country where the majority of poor renting families are giving at least half of their income to housing costs, and 1 in 4 are giving over 70% of their income just to pay rent and keep the utilities on.
And you're talking about half or 70% of what our low incomes to begin with. So there's very little left over.
That's exactly right. You know, someone like Arlene had just a little over $2 a day to make ends meet after her rent was paid.
You can't make ends meet on $2 a day.
She didn't. You know, she didn't. And I saw Arlene confront terrible situations. Should I pay my rent or feed my kids? Should I pay my rent or get the kids clothing they need for a new school year? Should I chip in for a funeral for when my sister dies? You know, these are the very difficult choices that low-income parents are facing out there because the rent takes so much of their income.
So in the time that you were following Arlene around, for example, how many times was she evicted?
I lost count. I lost count, and I think she did too. And so she was evicted from the unit that she was paying 88% of her income to rent in. She did help pay for a funeral when her sister died, not her sister in her the biological sense, but in the spiritual sense, a very close friend. And then she missed an appointment with a welfare caseworker because the letter announcing the appointment was mailed to a previous address from which she was evicted. And she got the pink papers and was evicted there. And I think the take home for me is that, you know, when you're paying so much of your income for housing, it doesn't take a major event to invite an eviction. Something as innocent as a snowball hitting a car and causing a man to kick your door in. That was the cause of one of Arlene's eviction.
That's the story you open your book with.
That's
whereas
right.
Her son threw a snowball at somebody, hit them, they came running and then kicked down the door. And the damage to the door then angered the landlord enough that he kicked her out.
That's right. You know, under these conditions, eviction is not always the result of irresponsibility. It's often the result of inevitability. You know, people just can't make ends meet when they're dedicating so much of their already low incomes to housing.
And tell us what happens when people are evicted in terms of what does – well, you already mentioned, you know, the issue of you lose your address,
right,
which can be really important.
Right.
But what is the sort of the cycle that kicks in with eviction?
When I started this book, I thought eviction would allow me to tell a different story about poverty in America. I'm now convinced that eviction is a cause, not just a condition of poverty. It makes things worse. So people lose not only their homes, but often their possessions, which are even either piled on the sidewalk or taken by movers. And you have to keep up payments. And a lot of folks just can't. You know, the biggest moving company in Milwaukee told me that about 70% of their moves that they do that are evictions or foreclosures just get thrown in the dump. You know, people lose their communities, children lose their schools. We have good evidence that workers often lose their jobs. And anyone listening out there who's been through an eviction or through foreclosure can tell you why. It's such a consuming, overwhelming, stressful event. It can cause you to make mistakes at work and eventually lose that job. And then there's the role that eviction plays in your mental health, your depression.
Yeah.
And we know, for example, that suicides attributed to foreclosures and evictions doubled between 2005 and 2010. And we have evidence that mothers who are evicted experience higher rates of depression 2 years later. So you add that all up, right? And you're left with a really strong picture, how eviction is driving people deeper into poverty and making their lives much harder.
Now, you said at the beginning, I think you said one out of eight renters in Milwaukee have been evicted during the time that you looked at, right?
That's right. And so we worked really hard to capture not only formal evictions that go through the court, mm-hmm, but informal evictions that don't. You know, I met a landlord that pays you to leave if you're out by the end of the month. I met a landlord that takes your door off. We try to capture all those kinds of informal evictions, as well as building foreclosure, building condemnations and landlord foreclosures. When you add all that up, it's about one in eight renters in the city of Milwaukee are evicted every 2 years. That's an astonishing number.
Yeah. Ralph Pendahl, he's talking about Milwaukee. What's your sense sort of more on a macro basis across the country? Does that one out of eight figure hold, or I'm sure it varies from locale to locale.
I'm sure it does vary from locale to locale, but one of the challenges is trying to capture a process that looks like an eviction to a social science researcher in the national data that we have. So we have a national survey that asks people open-ended questions about why they moved the last time they moved. And if the word eviction pops up there, then it's tracked. But maybe Matt can talk a little bit about what a small fraction of the people that he was interacting with would really use the word eviction to describe the process.
Well, it's got a lot of, it's a loaded term.
It is a loaded term.
It's like on your court record.
Yeah, and it's also a term of personal shame and failure in some cases. But what we do know from those national surveys is that the recession about 2009, 2010, we did have a peak in evictions. Since the economy's gotten better and since the worst of the disruption of the crisis has sort of passed and we're in a new phase now, evictions are down somewhat by these national statistics.
Matt, you were there in Milwaukee at just about the worst period, I guess, huh?
Yes, but, you know, evictions were high before the crash, and they're pretty darn high after the crash, too. You know, I remember my neighbors in the trailer park, Tim and Rose, and they were evicted. Their names appear in the eviction court. But if you ask them, like we do in our national surveys, were you evicted, they would have said no, because they think eviction is a sheriff coming, knocking on your door, taking your stuff, putting on the curb. That's an eviction. And so we need to have better ways of asking these questions. And that's why when we look at court records, they're much higher than self-administered surveys.
Matthew Desmond is the author of the book Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. He's a professor of sociology and co-director of the Justice and Poverty Project at Harvard University. He's also the recipient of a 2015 MacArthur Genius Grant. We're also joined here in the studio by Ralph Pendahl, who's director of the Metropolitan Housing and Communities Policy Center at the Urban Institute. We're talking about Matt's new book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. It's a fascinating book. There's a lot to go over. Dramatic stories from the people whose lives he followed. We're going to take a short break now. Please stay with us. Hello again. I'm Tom Gelton from NPR. I'm sitting in for Diane Rehm today, and we're talking about eviction and the role that it plays in aggravating or causing poverty in American cities. And my principal guest is Matthew Desmond, who has a terrific new book out, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. He's a sociologist at Harvard University. Also with us is Ralph Pendahl, who's director of the Metropolitan Housing and Communities Policy Center at the Urban Institute. Just before the break, we were talking about how eviction often sets in motion a sort of a cycle which makes everything worse for the people who go through it. We actually have an email here from Paul, who says, in my state, simply having a criminal record will exclude you from getting affordable housing or public housing in no matter what the crime was. How are these people supposed to get back on their feet when they cannot even get a roof over their head? Well, Paul, you should read Matt Desmond's book because it will totally reinforce your concerns. And Matt, I'm wondering if you can read. Your stories are so dramatic, and I think the best way to get to them is actually have you read one of the stories. I think you're going to read us about a woman that you're calling Vanetta.
Sure. So this passage has mention of something called The Lodge, which is a Salvation Army homeless shelter in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. A lot of the folks that I spend time with just called it The Lodge, so you can tell your kids we're staying at The Lodge tonight like it's a hotel. And it also mentions a woman named Crystal, who is someone that met Vanetta at the homeless shelter while they were both looking for a place to live. Vanetta Evans had been staying at the Lodge since January. At 20, she was not much older than Crystal, but she'd grown up fast. Vanetta had her first child, Kendall Jr., when she was 16, then a daughter, Timby, the next year. And a third, a year after that, a boy named Bobo. You might say that Vanetta was raised in the Rabbit Taylor Homes, Chicago's infamous public housing towers. Or you might say that her mentally challenged mother, whom Vanetta and her siblings unaffectionately called Shortcake, raised her in almost every homeless shelter in Illinois and Wisconsin. Crystal liked the way Vanetta carried herself. She was always put together, with her hair pulled back in a tight and small ponytail. She even wore her cell phone on her belt holder, like a landlord. Vanetta's dark brown skin matched Crystal's, and she had a smoky, lounge singer voice that she almost never raised at her kids. She could snap them in line by giving them the look. When Kendall Jr. acted up, Vanetta pretended to call Big Kendall, his father, on the phone. The boy knew she was faking, but would calm down anyway. When Bobo had seizures, she rushed him to the hospital. The two women began swapping cigarettes, each keeping mental note to the number of Newports given and received. Soon they upped the ante, taking incremental but expedited steps toward establishing a relationship of reciprocity. They exchanged snacks, then small bills, then meals purchased at fast food restaurants. Through passing references, they began learning about each other's resources. Vanetta received $673 a month from welfare and $380 a month in food stamps, as well as their character and their temperament. Crystal and Vanetta began calling each other sister. After a week, they decided to look for housing together. Roommates inside the homeless shelter would become roommates outside of it. Crystal didn't think she needed to worry about Vanetta's upcoming sentencing hearing. Prayer is a powerful thing, she said. Vanetta thought her chances of avoiding prison were decent even without Jesus. It was her first offense. The trouble had started when Old Country Buffet slashed Vanetta's hours. Instead of working 5 days a week, she would now only work one. Her manager blamed the recession. After that, Vanetta couldn't pay her electricity bill. We Energies threatened disconnection unless she paid $705. There was no way she could pay that and the rent. But she worried that Child Protective Services would take her kids away if her lights and gas were shut off. The thought of losing her children made Vanetta sick to her stomach. Then she fell behind in rent and received an eviction notice. She felt helpless and terrified. Her friend, who had also received the pink papers, felt the same way. One day, with Vanetta's boyfriend, the two women sat in a van and watched another pair of women walk into a Blockbuster carrying purses. Someone suggested robbing the women and splitting the money. Then, all of a sudden, that's what they were doing. Vanetta's boyfriend unloaded his gun and handed it to her friend. The friend ran from the van and pointed the pistol at the woman. Vanetta followed, collecting their purses. The cops picked them up a few hours later. In her confession, Vanetta had said, "I was desperate to pay my bills, and I was nervous and scared and did not want to see my kids in the dark or out on the street." When she turned 18, Vanetta had put her name on the list for public housing. Becoming a convicted felon meant that her chances of ever being approved were almost zero.
That's a dramatic story, a really compelling one. And we actually have Vanetta on the phone from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Vanetta, hello. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thank you all for having me.
Well, thanks for sharing your stories with us. And I'm sure hearing Matt read that section brings back a lot of memories for you. Your life has really improved a lot since then. But tell us a little bit more about that time, beginning with your experience at the lodge.
When I was, I had the three kids and I was staying in my own place. I was served with eviction papers to move around December of 08. At that point in time, I began looking for shelters and trying to find other places to live, but I barely had like resources to rely on or anything. So I continued to call shelters. I kept getting denied, They put my name on a waiting list at the shelter, and finally they accepted us. I told the kids one day that we was going to stay at a hotel, like Matt mentioned. We usually tell them it's a hotel so they wouldn't have to, like, ask so many questions or be worried. They really didn't understand what the shelter was at that point in time anyway. So we went there. We stayed there for a while. During that time, we looked for housing and tried to find a place to stay with my kids. It was so hard at that time. I felt like I was all alone, like I was invisible, like nobody didn't care. I kept getting turned down. Even before I committed my crime, before winding up at the shelter, I tried to ask for help. I tried to take advantage of the different resources that was out here, but it's like nobody would have helped me by me having a fresh eviction on my name. I was told that nobody wanted to rent to somebody like that.
So, Vanetta, how many times did you, how many times did you look for an apartment? How many times did you apply to rent a property?
Oh, my God. It was probably like 100 times.
Oh.
I kept getting denied. And then at that point in time, I had a fresh crime. So it was like double jeopardy. Not only do I have this eviction on my name, but I have like a conviction as well. Like if somebody C-capped me, it was right there. They can see it. So nobody wanted to rent with somebody with evictions or that was facing, had a criminal background. So I just kept getting denied. So finally, the place that we did end up in at that point in time, I got tired of looking at so many places and being on the street and staying with people and getting put out and worrying about how we was going to make it through the day or where we was going to sleep at night or how I was going to feed the kids. So I just took The first thing that somebody accepted to me and the kids, I just took it. I didn't care how it looked. I just felt like long as we had a place over our head at that point in time, and we were safe off the street.
And Vanetta, you mentioned at one point that you were concerned about that they would C-cap you. What do you mean by that?
It's a process that you go through when you're looking for housing. The landlords usually tell you they're going to do a background check on you, which most of them refer to C-cap. And when they pull your record up,
That's some kind of online record keeping.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And when they pull it up, then they see the eviction popped up, which was fresh that year. And then now I got a criminal court charge that I'm facing. So that was like a big turnoff for landlords. And then I was receiving W-2 at the time, and they was worried, like, how are we going to get our money? Most of them wanted, like, a payment up front, last month's payment, plus security deposit. Mind you, I'm only getting $673 on W-2, and it's just me at that point in time. So it was, like, it was hard. It was stressful. I felt depressed, and I didn't know what to do.
Well, and you all the time had your children to worry about, and it sounds like one of your children is with you right now as we speak.
Yes, yes. I have one of the little ones with me.
So your story ends rather happily, and of course for many people who are caught up in this cycle of poverty and eviction, it doesn't end so well. How were you able, what did you have to do to finally take charge of your life, or how were you able to turn things around in your own life? I now understand you're now studying to be a dental hygienist.
I am. I just started school for that. But where I'm staying now, I kind of been there for almost 2 years. My main thing was just to, like, build some rental history. So when I do get ready to go out and search for better housing, somewhere nice for the kids to be able to go outside and play without hearing gunshots or me being worried about them, I just decided to take whatever was handed to me. When I got out of jail, like I said, it was even harder finding a place. So when I did find one, I just choose to stay there for a while and try to build up a little bit of rental history, so when I do get ready to move into somewhere nice, I won't have that, like, following me, or you move around too much, or you're not able to pay the rent, or just anything that will hinder me from getting a nice place.
But I'm sure a lot of the people you know, a lot of the people that you've lived with over the years or known over the years have had a lot of difficulty getting out of the situation, the situations like the one you were in.
Yes.
Right.
It's hard. I really don't know how some people get out of it. I know I got out of it by trying to just stay positive, try to take as many as resources out here as far as bettering myself. When it came to school, I got back in school. I got my GED. I kept a job for a while. I'm still at the job. Like, I just tried to change the way I was living and try to, like, think more positive, if you want to say. Like, mm-hmm.
Well, congratulations to you, Vanetta. We're rooting for you, and we're really pleased that you have been able to think in a more positive term. Have you read part of Matt's book? Like, for example, the part right now that he read for us where he talks about you. Have you seen that before?
I did. I cried. Every time I read that part, I cried because it was like that was one of my hardest times in life right there. And as a kid, like Matt mentioned in the book, I grew up in every shelter, basically in Illinois and Milwaukee. I didn't have a stable place over my head. I didn't have proper food, or I didn't even know sometimes how I was going to eat that night. We missed meals multiple nights, and it was hard, and all I ever wanted for my kids was not to put them through that. I just wanted to give them something different. And at that point in time, when I was reading that book, I felt like a failure. I was like, I did everything that I didn't want to do.
Well,
I just felt like I failed at being a parent to my kids.
Well, you haven't been a failure. Mm-hmm. So we, as I say, we are proud of you for what you have accomplished, and I'm sure that your kids will be proud of you as well.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us. Vanetta of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and her family's experience is written about in Matthew Desmond's new book, Evicted. Again, Vanetta, thanks for calling. I know it's hard.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for having me.
So, Matt, seven more stories like Vanetta's in your book, seven more families that you profile.
That's right. And I think that, you know, the book profiles the hard stuff, but it also profiles these moments of generosity and these moments of humor. You know, it tells you that Vanetta organized an Easter egg hunt at the shelter for her kids. It tells you a time where she and Crystal, when they were homeless, you know, pooled their money and bought this young boy lunch, you know, who was looking for scraps at a McDonald's, you know. And it shows me how gracefully and powerfully people like Vanetta refuse to be reduced to their hardships.
Matt Desmond, his book is Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. I'm Tom Gelton. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And how did you find these people, Matt? How did you? I mean, you said that you move into the rooming house or the trailer park, and then I think you said at one point that you hung out in the office of the trailer park and you met people as they came in. And one of the really interesting things about your book is that you seem to be as interested in the landlords and the people on that end as you were with the tenants themselves.
I think that's absolutely right. And we let ourselves off the hook if we just say, oh, these tenants, you know, they made mistakes. Or these landlords, you know, they're just greedy. You know, the reality is it's a lot more complicated than that.
Well, you say poverty is a relationship,
right,
which is really interesting.
Right. You know, we have to think about how poverty isn't just a result of low incomes, jobs, and joblessness. It's also a result of extractive markets. You know, some people make money off poor folks. Some people make quite a lot of money off poor folks. But I think that, you know, if we're going to house the vast majority of our low-income families in the private market, landlords have to be at the table and we have to understand their perspectives.
Ralph Pendle, we talked before about the trends in this. What is the sort of the larger economic context that explains this great problem of access to housing? Why in this country is housing itself such a problem for so many families?
It's a big problem right now because of two coinciding forces. One of them is the lingering effects of the Great Recession. The economy's coming back, but wages really haven't recovered for a lot of people. And not everybody's gone back to work who stopped working or gone to work who might have gone to work if it hadn't been for the recession. People who might have moved into homeownership are still renting. And so this is the rental markets are clogged with those folks. In addition, we have this big new generation, the millennials, who are starting to move out of their parents' basements. And so we have really pretty strong rental housing demand right now. And so that's caused rental vacancy rates to drop all over the United States. Rents are going up. In the last 2 years, the inflation rate for rent has been 10 times the inflation rate for everything else. And if people's paychecks are getting adjusted based on that general cost of inflation, they're not able to keep up with the rent.
Now, food stamps are an important part of the safety net, and basically everybody can get them. Why is it so different for housing? Why do food stamps go to everybody, but so few, I think Matt said, one out of four families that need housing assistance get it?
The country has never made a commitment to supporting all low-income people with enough money to pay their rent. It's been discussed, but it's never been enough a priority to say it's a universal right that everyone should have to have a stable place to live.
And Matt, did you, after going through this experience and writing this terrific book, have you come to any conclusions about what has to happen?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, we're in Washington, D.C. right now. The waiting list for public housing in our nation's capital is not counted in years. It's counted in decades.
Decades.
Decades. So if a young parent applied for public housing here in Washington, D.C., she or he literally might be a grandparent by the time the application comes up. This is causing an enormous amount of suffering and pain. It's a cold denial of basic rights. I mean, Vanetta is such an amazing mom. Mm-hmm. You know, she cared deeply about her kids, and we squander that talent, and we squander her ability to reach her full potential and allow our kids to reach her full potential because we're not offering her basic affordable housing.
Matthew Desmond is the author of the book Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, also a professor of sociology and co-director of the Justice and Poverty Project at Harvard University. And we're talking about his new book. We're going to take a short break right now, and when we get back, we have a board here that's loaded with phone calls, and we're going to go to the calls. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Tom Gelton from NPR, sitting in for Diane Rehm today, and we're talking about the housing crisis in America with Matthew Desmond, who's the author of a new book, Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. He's a professor of sociology at Harvard University. I'm also joined by Rolf Pendel from the Urban Institute, who focuses on housing issues there. Now, Matt, before the break, we were talking about your efforts to look at this from not only the tenant's point of view, but also the landlord's point of view. And you spent a lot of time with landlords as you told the story, because you wanted to understand the relationship between the tenants and the landlords.
That's absolutely right. I wanted to know why a landlord would evict you, but not me. I wanted to know why you'd buy and manage property where you do. I wanted to know what makes them tick and just kind of what influences them. Yeah.
And we are actually joined on the phone today at this hour by Tim Ballering, who's the founder and owner of Affordable Rental Associates, LLC, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And there he oversees the rent and management of apartments of low-income tenants. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
And so tell us a little bit, if you can, from, you know, how do you see these issues developing? You are someone who is committed to providing affordable housing for low-income people. How difficult is that? And do you have any sense, you know, sort of from a landlord's point of view, how these situations develop?
Yes. You know, I think there's a misperception that landlords somehow win, or they enjoy, or whatever, the eviction process. And in reality, everybody loses in the eviction. A typical eviction, by the time it's all done, it has cost the landlord 2 to 3 months' rent. It's cost the court costs, the movers. So in every one of these evictions, the landlord has also lost. And you know, we do evictions, of course. You cannot run properties if you're not collecting the rent. It's very expensive. People don't understand the amount of expense involved in running properties, especially in older properties and lower-income neighborhoods. And for the most part, the tenants that we evict are not bad people. It's just bad situations that an owner cannot afford not to collect the rent. You have maintenance to pay for. You have taxes to pay for.
Well, what can you do as a landlord? I mean, you are committed to providing affordable rental associates. And what, you know, what has your approach been in order to do that?
Well, we attempt to work out situations. We attempt to work with, you know, organizations that provide different services. In Wisconsin, we have emergency assistance, which they help pay rent to avoid, it's through the state, they help pay rent to avoid eviction. We work with some of the community groups to find what resources. But it doesn't always work out. It's a situation that I think that needs to change. I agree with Matt on many, many aspects of this, that a change has to occur. And landlords have to be part of that, not forced down upon them, but part of the overall solution. And both landlords helping with the solution, but also landlords being helped with the solution. A fair number of the smaller landlords that are undercapitalized have a hard time surviving evictions. If they lose 3 months' rent, now they're behind on their taxes, they're behind on their water, they're behind on their mortgages.
Now, one of the things that Matt talks about in his book and that Rolf has also written about is the use of possible use of housing vouchers. Is that something that you think might be a good idea?
I think it's an excellent idea. Once Matt's done with his book tour, I want to talk to him about how we can work together to try to achieve something in Milwaukee or legislatively at Madison, Wisconsin, and maybe his next book could be housed where everybody has a home. I think that there are answers out there, not enough.
Yeah. Well, Tim,
resources are given.
Yeah. Okay. Not enough resources are going into it. Well, Tim, really, we appreciate you calling in with your perspective. You sound like a sympathetic landlord and one who is committed to doing whatever you can from your perspective to address this crisis. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's Tim Ballering. He's the founder and owner of Affordable Rental Associates in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where he oversees the management of apartments for low-income tenants. We have a number of callers now with different experiences in this area that they want to share with us. Let's go first to David, who's on the line from Indianapolis, Indiana. Hello, David. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hey. Good afternoon, gentlemen. This is an outstanding show. Thank you very much. And I wanted to say I'm a salesman. I work in the field. And initially I started out doing this in our outlying area, some of our suburbs of Indianapolis. But now I work for a company that works in the city of Indianapolis. And this has become so obviously apparent to us. I mean, daily I see people's belongings left at the curb. There is a business started where people have their trucks and go around looking for these evictions and pick through folks' stuff and take it and sell it and do whatever. That literally has started a business. I've seen three different men in trucks regularly doing this that has become so evidently bad.
And David, you say you see doing your door-to-door sales, you see evictions happening, did you say every day?
Pretty much daily, I see something where I run into. Just recently, I ran into one where they were literally throwing these folks out their things out the second story window because they didn't feel like carrying them down, breaking everything, tearing up everything, then pushing it out to the curb. End of story. I don't see an actual eviction every day. I see the results of an actual eviction every day.
Right. And Matt, David mentioned that there are people that make money off evictions. He talks about people going around and picking through people's possessions and reselling them. You talk in your book about moving companies that specialize in the eviction business.
That's right. And, you know, there's a lot of folks that have kind of sprung up and come around the fact that we're evicting families, not by the tens or even the hundreds of thousands, but likely in the millions every day in America. It's not just in Milwaukee. It's not just in San Francisco and New York. You know, it's in Indianapolis and Cincinnati and Cleveland, Ohio. And so this is a book that's set in Milwaukee, but this tells a deeper American story.
Ralph, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, and I think I'd also say that the visible part of eviction is only really the tip of the iceberg when it comes to instability in housing situations. And I think this is actually something that Matt is working on right now, really trying to get a handle on, you know, what's down below the surface in terms of the way that the housing crisis disrupts people's lives. So, Matt, do you have any? I'd love to hear sort of your thinking about sort of what else is out there that you're looking for.
You mean in the data? Right now, we're trying to get eviction records from every single county in the United States to understand if certain cities have different levels of eviction, what kind of laws are working, and the neighborhood consequences of eviction. So this is something that we're trying to get after. You're absolutely right that those evictions, however violent, are the tip of the iceberg. And there's a lot more forced moves that go on other than just the ones that you see where the effects are lining the curb.
But there's the folks who may have a family member they can rely on for a little while. They move in with a family member for a couple of weeks. Things get a little bit dicey at home. They have to move, and they go from place to place. I'm sort of wondering about those aspects of the housing crisis that that are also, you know, part of this. And, you know, they may not end up evicted, but they certainly end up destabilized. And
they create family situations, problematic family situations, it sounds like.
It's tough, you know, and a lot of the folks that I spent time with, they sometimes relied on their family, but often they couldn't. You know, their family just wasn't there. They didn't have enough resources. And so they relied on strangers and acquaintances, people they met at the homeless shelter or bus stop, to make ends meet. And the way that people are addressing these conditions of extreme poverty is both with ingenuity and courage, but also in a way that has really deep consequences for their lives and their children's lives.
Let's go down to Nick, who's on the line from Bainbridge, Pennsylvania. Hello, Nick. Thanks for calling the Diane Rehm Show.
Yeah, good morning.
Your comment or question?
I was a landlord, not by choice. I had bought a house when I was 20 years old before the market crashed, and by the time I was ready to move, I owed way more than it was worth. So I decided to rent it out.
Uh-huh.
And my very last tenant, I decided to go through Section 8.
And what does that mean? You know, what does that mean, Nick?
Section 8 is the affordable housing in Lancaster City. And it's the government-subsidied housing. And to get it, the landlord has to go to the county office and say, I'm willing to accept Section 8 tenants. Then they have to come and approve your house.
And then you get criteria. And then you get some assistance from the government, I guess, in covering your costs, huh?
Well, yeah, the government then pays these people's rent.
Okay.
So.
And how did that work out? And
it's, I'm sorry?
Did that work out for you then?
It worked out horribly. It was absolutely horrible. My tenant ended up asking if she could break her lease early because she wanted to, she got approved for Section 8 in a neighboring school district, which was a better school district.
Uh-huh.
And being a father, I was like, yeah, of course you can break your lease early. You know, I'm all about, you know, your kids being in a better school district. So I did her this favor, wrote her a note saying that, you know, I hereby allow you to break your lease, you know, upon, you know, these few things being repaired. She had started some home improvement jobs that she wanted to put a new kitchen floor in and a new sink, which I allowed her to do on her own dime because, you know, she was living there and I wanted her to have things that she wanted. Well, the day came that she was supposed to move out and she didn't move out. Well, Section 8 stopped paying me because they were already paying her new landlord at that time. So the end of the month comes around. She won't let me in the house. I need to check on the repair. She won't let me in the house. So I have to go through the eviction process at this point.
Yeah.
And even though she had broke her lease, even though the state was paying her rent, there was nothing I could do to get her out of my house. Yeah. I had to take her to court 3 times in 30-day increments. The whole time I'm not making any rent on a house that I'm still paying the full mortgage for, all the insurance, all the utilities. And she ended up owing me like $8,000 when it was all said and done with the damages she did to my house that she all never repaired.
Okay, Nick. That is a story from the landlord's perspective. I'm Tom Gelton. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And you know what, Matt, what Nick's story reveals, I think, is that the whole system is broken, as it were. I mean, from whether you're a landlord or a tenant, there are a lot of problems in the way that governments are handling this issue.
We could do a lot better out there. I think the big picture, though, is, you know, most folks are just crushed by the high cost of housing, and that's putting them in incredibly desperate situations. You know, for Nick's story, I could match Nick's story with a horror story about a landlord. You know, and there are tenants out there that abuse landlords, and there are landlords out there that abuse tenants. But the bigger picture is, do we in this country believe that housing is a basic right for everyone that lives here? Do we believe that stable, affordable housing is something that what it means to be an American? And I think we have to answer yes, because without stable shelter, everything else falls apart. We know that when people finally get a housing voucher after years and years on the waiting list, the number one thing that they do with it is they go to the grocery store and they buy more food and their kids become stronger and healthier. But a lot of kids out there, like Vanetta's kids and Arlene's kids, weren't getting enough to eat because the rent eats first. We don't have to accept that situation.
Well, as you say, I mean, we seem to have understood that everybody needs food, which is why we have food stamps, but we haven't reached that point yet on housing.
Right. But we've affirmed, you know, basic education, access to decent nutrition, provision in old age, because we know those things are fundamental to human flourishing and economic mobility. And it's impossible to argue that housing isn't fundamental to those things as well.
We have an email from Bonnie who writes, and this is something we haven't actually gotten into too much, and that's about the sort of the legal procedures that follow eviction. There is no legal requirement, she writes, that people facing eviction have free access to a lawyer. This is due to the fact that civil representation is not required. In the area I live, the Legal Service Center reports that there are over 3,000 cases that go unserved each year due to this problem. And you actually have some very moving sections in your book, Matt, where you were in a housing court, and you write about the lack of representation that tenants facing eviction have.
That's right. Unlike in criminal court, low-income families that are facing eviction or foreclosure have no right to a lawyer at all. So in some housing courts around the country, 90% of landlords have attorneys and 90% of tenants do not. Now, if you're someone like Arlene that has, you know, 11th grade education and you have to go and face your landlord's attorney, you might not even show up. And a lot of tenants don't. About 70% of tenants who are summoned to eviction court in Milwaukee just don't show up and receive a default eviction judgment. I think extending legal aid to indigent tenants in housing court would curb illegal evictions, would make sure families don't sign bad stipulations, which are the civil court's plea bargain, and would allow cases to be heard, unlike the majority of them. Families could go to work or they could stay with their kids while their attorney serves their case. It's a smart use of public funds to stem the fallout from eviction upstream so we don't end up paying for it financially and morally downstream.
As I say, you have a very pointed description of what those housing courts are like, where you see the lawyers on one side and the tenants on the other side, most of whom are black women, I think you said.
Yeah, I
in
mean,
the case in Milwaukee.
Yeah, I mean, the face of America's eviction epidemic belongs to mothers and kids. Anyone that's been to a housing court can see kids running everywhere. And this has a disproportionate effect on low-income African-American communities. But it's not just in those communities. You know, it's affecting immigrant communities, low-income white communities. One in five of all renters in the United States report paying at least 50% of their income to housing.
And one of the great lines in your book is that black men get locked up, black women get locked out.
Black women are disproportionately facing the fallout of eviction. Yeah, absolutely.
Matt Desmond is the author of a terrific new book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. We're also joined by Rolf Pendel from the Urban Institute. And earlier, we actually heard from one of the people in Matt's book, Vanetta, not her real name. She lives in Milwaukee, and she shared with us her experience with evictions and how she has managed to turn her life around. We are also joined on the phone a bit earlier by Tim Ballering, who is a landlord, the founder and owner of Affordable Rental Associates in Milwaukee, talking about the difficulties from a landlord's point of view. It's been a terrific hour. Thanks for coming in. Thanks to our listeners. I'm Tom Gelton. This is the Diane Rehm Show.